And a good morning to you. A happy Friday. I'm Norman Gilliland. Of course, the weekend is upon us, and that means, this being January 19th, a concert tonight by the Madison Symphony, also on the 20th, and then Sunday afternoon, the 21st, the concert will include, well, it's an all-Russian concert, the wonderful Love for Three Oranges Suite of Prokofiev, Rachmaninoff's Third Symphony, and the centerpiece, the beloved virtuosic Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, played by Gil Shaham. And welcome to the 11 o'clock hour, Gil.
Thank you. So nice to be here with you.
All right, let's sort this out first. You just go by Gil, which is fine, but you do have a last name, and there's a little controversy or a disagreement about how to actually say it.
Well, the truth is that I never say it, so I don't know how to say it in English. And what you just said was fine. In Hebrew, I guess you would say my first name Gil, and then Shaham, you know, mm-hmm. for a last name. And in English, I get Gil and I Shaham, sometimes Shaham, Shazam, you know. Do you remember Shazam?
I do.
I was a child, I used to read the Shazam books.
Yeah, I had a roommate whose last name was Azam, A-Z-A-M, and he asked me one time, why did somebody put an S-H in front of my name on my study, Carol?
Right.
Well, Shazam. Anyway, okay, I'm glad we got that sort of settled, but if we call you Gil, then it should be Shaham rather than going with the more Hebraic first name.
Please call me Gil.
Got it. Okay, got that settled. Closure at last. And so just a couple of words about this Tchaikovsky, although we could, of course, go into great detail about it. It was pronounced unplayable by the first intended violinist in Tchaikovsky's time. And it was called, I think it was Edward Hanslick, the critic, who said that this Tchaikovsky concerto stinks to the ear.
Yes, he did say that.
So what was that all about?
But audiences have disagreed ever since.
They have.
You know, what a miracle of a piece this is, what a treasure it is for us violinists and for audiences. You know, for a composer who lived mostly a rather tortured life.
Yes, lots of self-doubt.
Lots of self-doubt and, you know, really an outcast from society. He was in the midst of maybe the happiest few months of his life when he was inspired to write this piece, and he was in love with this young violinist and wrote it for him. And it really is the most incredible inspiration. We have friends at my kid's school. The father is a percussionist, and he told me, Gil, you know, when I was 13 years old, I knew nothing about music. I had nothing to do with music. It was the last thing on my mind. I went to a concert, and I heard the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. I thought I'd never heard anything like that. And it changed his life. He decided to become a percussionist after having heard this piece.
That's a little unusual, isn't it? I mean, violinist, you could see, but a percussionist.
Yes. Even my my niece, who's 11 years old, and she's a, you know, she studies piano. She's very accomplished. She's a very good pianist. But she started listening to the Tchaikovsky Concerto. And she told me a couple of months ago, she said, you know that part in the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto where the tutti comes in, where the orchestra finally comes in with that tune, and they finally come in on that big, you know, there's the big outburst in the orchestra in A major. And she says, I love that part. That's my favorite part in music. And her dad, and I said to her, you know, Eliana, I feel the same about that part. When I was maybe 13 years old, I remember listening to that over and over and over. Her dad says, you know, she listens to that 100 times a day. Every time she just gets to that part and she rewinds and she listens. And what can you say when music inspires people that way? You know, we really are very lucky to have
Well, it is one of those works that has really caught on. It becomes more popular, I think, with each passing year. And it's hard now to see, listening to it, how it could ever have been otherwise.
Also, the violin writing is so perfect. I guess this last holiday season, I went with my kids. We went to see the Nutcracker. It's a bit of a family tradition. And another just miracle of music. And I was just so struck by how the violin writing is so perfect and it's so idiosyncratic. And I think composers ever since, you know, either consciously or unconsciously, have been writing for the violin the way that Tchaikovsky did, you know?
So when you say idiosyncratic, that implies so not so idiomatic then. I mean, this has a reputation of being a very difficult piece to play.
Well, I may have used the wrong word. My English is not, it's not my forte. But there's something about the way things sing on the violin, maybe in the same way Mozart makes the violin sing. Tchaikovsky also makes the violin sing. The way he adds grace notes and embellishments, and the way he uses the sort of folk, you know, traditional Russian folk fiddling elements in his writing for violin.
And your job is to make it seem effortless. All of that.
Hopefully I don't get in the way too much and people can still enjoy the music.
You have your own label, Canary Classics, and you have several releases on that label.
Yes. This was something that we started, I want to say, more than a decade ago. And really what's happened is that technology has set us free. You know, I think in many ways, artists today have incredible freedoms that we never had before. When I started recording in the 80s, it might have been the 1880s now that I think about it.
But, good year for Tchaikovsky.
But maybe you remember, you know, we used to have, you know, machines the size of refrigerators.
Yes, yeah.
Big Dolby machines, you know.
Yeah, big reel-to-reel, 10-inch reels.
Exactly, 10-inch reels. And people used the razor blades to,
oh, yes,
to edit the, you know. And now you can really get the highest quality recording basically on your laptop or maybe even on your phone, you know. And that's been very freeing. And now many, many orchestras, many arts organizations, many individual musicians like myself own their own music because it turns out there are many advantages, not the least of which are artistic.
Sure, well,
to
that's
owning
true
your own music.
And you decide when it's going to be released.
And what you're going to record, yeah, and where and when. And so there are many, many advantages to.
Well, this particular one on the Canary Classic label features you and your sister, Orly, and a collection of Hebrew melodies, one of the most famous being that one of Joseph Achron.
Yes.
What's going on in here?
Oh, I love this piece. When you mentioned that piece, I immediately go to a memory of my grandfather. You know, I remember as a child, he used to sort of hum or sing. You know, he would sing this tune around the house, and it's sort of bim bam bom kind of syllables, boom 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 boom, bim bam boom boom boom. This kind of, you know, and he would sing this tune. Joseph Achron was an amazing composer. I think Arnold Schoenberg at one point, I will not remember the exact quote, but something like called him the most promising composer of our day, or something like that. He embarked on a mission along with many other composers in Europe, mostly in Russia and Germany, Poland, to take Jewish folk music and bring it to the concert stage. And I think the idea was sort of to do what Glinka had done for Russian music and do that for traditional Jewish music. You know, the same thing that Grieg had done for Norwegian music, or later Bartok for
Hungarian music. Yeah, it was a long-standing trend, wasn't it? That was kind of nationalism in music.
That's exactly it. And this is maybe one of the most famous results of
Hebrew
of those
Melody by
efforts.
Joseph Achron with Gil and Orly Shaham.
Thank you.
Hebrew Melody by Joseph Achron. Gil and Orle Shaham, the violinist and pianist, respectively, and that's the sound then of the 1699 Strad.
For you, 1499.
I'll take it. I'll definitely take it. That is one of those enduring pieces, isn't it? So soulful, and of course, it does require really wonderful violinist to pull off the subtleties of the sounds.
Thank you. No, very, very somber. And also, like you say, very violin-y. Is that a
violinistic?
Word? Violinistic. Violin, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine it on any number of other instruments. On your, and this came from that label, the Canary Classics label, you also have this series of 1930s violin concertos. And
yes.
Was that really just a rationale for playing some great violin concertos? I mean, they do sort of hold together a little bit, the 30s sound, but they come from such different backgrounds, it can't be too closely related.
Well, that's exactly, you're exactly right. And I've been saying that this has been really sort of an excuse for me to play some of my favorite music. But it is interesting when you look at the violin concertos that were written in the 1930s, there was suddenly a spike, you know, of great concertos written by, you know, very famous, great composers. And I remember reading this list to a friend of mine, you know, from 19, it's not even the decade of the 30s, it's in 8 years, from 31 to 39, we have concertos by Stravinsky and Prokofiev, and Béla Bartók, and Hindemith, and
Barber,
and Roger Sessions, and Alban Berg, and Arnold Schoenberg, and Darius Milhaud, and Benjamin Britten, and William Walton, and Carl Amadeus Hartmann, you know, and I'm leaving out many, you know, Carl Szymanowski.
What was that all about, do you suppose?
Ernst Bloch, and I remember reading this list to a friend, and he said, well, Gil, you've just named all the great composers of the 20th century. And it's maybe not all, but maybe 90%, you know. So many really wrote violin concertos simultaneously.
That's true. And if you add just a couple years at the end of that, You get the Kachaturian.
Kachaturian, 1940.
And the Korngold in 45, fact, I think, for that one.
The Korngold was in, yeah, that's exactly right. It was published in 45, but most of the material was written in the 30s.
Yes, right. It was movie music that he kind of folded into the violin concerto. So, yeah, that was quite the genre then, the violin concerto in those years, for whatever reason.
So, it's, you know, I really don't have any answers, but I enjoyed asking the questions. And there was a very eloquent patron of the National Symphony in Washington who came backstage once and said, I think we'd played the Alban Berg concerto. I may be wrong, but he came backstage and he said, look, the 1930s was such an intense time, you know.
People, wherever you were.
People lived with, you know, trepidation and turbulence, you know. He said it much better than that. But he said the feeling was as if they were on the edge of a volcano waiting for the eruption.
Which, as it turned out, they were.
And he said, how does that relate to the music of that time? And how does that relate to our times and the music of our times? And, of course, I don't know the answer, but I think it's very thought-provoking and interesting.
Now to something, speaking of trepidation, but I think of a more pleasurable kind, let's say, this by John Williams. You have a CD. It's, of course, the violin has long been associated with things, you know, demonic and
yes,
dark.
Yes, the devil's instrument.
Ever since the devil's trill, and maybe even before that, back in the Baroque era. And so you have a CD from, about 2000. Called Devil's Dance, which has quite a variety on it. And this was actually put out by Deutsche Grammophon. Devil's Dance is also the first track, and it's by none other than John Williams.
Well, I'm very honored to have this piece. I was sitting at a dinner with John Williams in Tanglewood in Massachusetts, and the conversation turned around to witches' covens, and apparently up,
of course,
and apparently up in the Berkshires, there are some active, real, practicing witches' covens, and we started speaking about that. And of course, John had written the score to the film *The Witches of Eastwick*, and I don't know if you remember this movie.
I remember the title. I don't think I ever actually saw the film.
Jack Nicholson.
Oh, I'll say no more.
And I believe he played the devil.
Uh-huh. And, that would work.
And Susan Sarandon, and I'm forgetting who the other two leading ladies were. Maybe Michelle Pfeiffer. But in one scene, Jack Nicholson picks up the violin and starts playing. He may be playing the Tchaikovsky violin concerto. Maybe. I'm not sure. And the violin, you know, lights up in flames, and he's playing some incredible virtuosic passage. And so we started speaking about this Witches of Eastwick movie, and I'd mentioned to John how much I loved his soundtrack to that movie. And would he possibly consider writing a short encore piece based on that?
Oh, great.
And that's the piece that resulted, the Devil's Dance short piece for violin and piano, which is like the perfect encore piece for any Halloween recital.
Maybe even in an off-Halloween recital.
Absolutely.
The pianist, yes, for this occasion, Jonathan Feldman, the violinist, my guest today, Gil Shaham. So is that as hard to play as it sounds, even for a great violinist such as Gil Shaham?
Well, I just heard a little bit now here in the studio. I was thinking I should maybe look at this because it's going to take some practicing to bring it back up.
Are you going to be playing it again then, you think?
I hope to, yes.
It'll be quite the showstopper. My guest, Gil Shaham, and also some Tchaikovsky, too. This is a recording from, 25 years ago of you playing the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And in the finale, is that, do you suppose, what caused someone, a prominent violinist, to call it unplayable, or is this no more difficult than the rest of this concerto?
Yeah, there are definitely some new patent passage work in the finale. You know, I'm not sure what the violinists at the time were referring to. But I must say, even though it's very impressive and very... some of the passages are difficult sounding, they do lie very well on the violin, and they make perfect sense. He really was very fluent in violin writing.
And he did consult extensively with, was it Brodsky? I can't remember the violinist for whom with whom he consulted on this.
Yes, and he wrote for violin throughout his life, so it wasn't a new thing for him to write for the violin.
You still get to show considerable virtuosity, regardless of how idiomatic this may or may not be, I'm guessing.
And I think this is one of the great endings of any classical work, certainly of violin concertos, you know, the build up to the end, the big final cadence, the arriving in D major, the battle between soloist and orchestra, you know, getting phrases getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, and finally big release. It really is very, very satisfying music.
The finale of the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto in D, Gil Shaham, the violinist, and the Philharmonia Orchestra led by Giuseppe Sinopoli back around 1992.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
That's just the finale of the Tchaikovsky Piano Violin Concerto, the Concerto in D, in a performance by Gail Shaham and the Philharmonia Orchestra led by Giuseppe Sinopoli.